This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
If you wanted a window into contradiction, the Idaho State Police just handed us a whole house tour. We're talking about more than 500 images from Brian Koberger's world, his WSU apartment, his Elantra, the quiet corners where routine meets aftermath. On one side, you have the everyday signs of a grand student or a grad student, textbooks cracked open, assignments floating around the room, birthday cards from family dropping in just days after the murders. And on the other, you have the method, the bagged hairs, the stained bedding, the car pulled apart and dusted like it's giving up state secrets. The place looks almost underdecorated or undecorated, impersonal, like it was a temporary living stage set, if you will. But in the spaces where his body would have been after the crimes and before, the bed, the living room, things read as scrubbed, controlled, purposeful, and very much in line with what you'd expect from the home of Brian Koberger. In the spaces he didn't expect to matter, pantry, cupboards, a little domestic junk drawer of life, chaos. Here's why it all still matters now. These photos won't change outcomes, but they do refine the public record. They help us understand how he operated when no one was watching, what he prioritized, what he ignored, where he anticipated scrutiny, and where he gambled he could get away with mess. The Elantra tells its own story. White residue from processing, parts essentially disassembled. If the working belief was you can't clean everything, the counterpoint is on those seats, pedals, and seams, he tried. The question becomes not just what investigators found, but what the patterns of cleaning and not cleaning signal about planning, panic, and the mental load of covering up violence in a small life. Ethically, there's another line to walk. Families don't want graphic images out there. I hear that. You hear that. And most of what's been released so far avoids the worst of that. Still, the scale of the dump guaranteed misreads. People scour photos for meaning that really isn't there. So our job here is to look closely without pretending a pile of grocery shelf chaos is a diagnostic manual. We're going to parse what's actually probative and what's just voyeuristic. Joining me to do just that, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. We've both pored over these photos, Jen. We've now seen inside that so-called home lair of Brian Koberger, whatever you want to call it. Anything standing out to you?
I mean, really what stood out to me, and I tried to point this out, I'm not sure if I did a great job at it, but basically the areas where he would be, where his body would have been after the crimes, any place he would have touched in that sort of regard, like his bed, his living room, where was he, seemed very clean. What really I found interesting was his pantry, his icebox, other areas that were just completely disheveled. What it showed to me was that it seemed that he was very OCD, if you will, when it came to cleanup, but probably not that OCD. And I'm using that as a term to mean, you know, concerned about how things are kept. Mm-hmm. He didn't seem to be that way with his normal routine.
That stood out to me as well. And I know you tweeted about it too, because we look at so many things about him and we think, oh gosh, he must be so OCD the way he wants to control everything. And we've even seen that footage from inside his cell, his Crocs lined up very neatly. Things are very much in their place. But when we got a chance to see inside his house, fairly unextraordinary, not a whole lot on the walls, if anything at all, but yeah, I mean, the kitchen was kind of in disarray. The cupboards were kind of in disarray. Were you surprised by that?
I really was. And of course, many of us have watched that footage in his cell, as you mentioned, you know, his shoes all lined up. He's cleaning about. He's lining everything up. Listen, I understand that there's multiple layers to a true diagnosis of being OCD, but I'm talking about somebody who, when it came to cleaning up after this crime, wow, This was somebody who was organized and methodical and couldn't clean enough. And so to me, that stuck out as him trying to cover everything up.
Does it also show, I mean, they always say, you know, like things around you are kind of a reflection of what's in your head, as scientific as of saying that is, I know. But it is, I think, somewhat true. If things are kind of in disarray around you, oftentimes it does kind of reflect what may be going on with one personally. Do you think that the disarray in this area that was just the closest to Brian Koberger, nobody else is interacting with his, you know, can of Pringles and chips and things that are sitting around the house other than him, but all those things that were just meant for him, just only for him to see, only for him to be concerned with, bothered by, consumed, whatever, all of that was in a disarray, while all of the forward sitting things, the forward focusing things that people can see on the outside were not. It really kind of showed an interesting, you know, on the inside, he didn't seem to be in all that of an organized human being.
Well, I truly think that nexus had to do with the cleanup. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at his bathroom. Oh my goodness. I mean, and I mean, it was unbelievable. And yeah, juxtapose that, like I tried to do, to the cupboard. And to me, it just pointed out that when he cared about something being perfect and in order, because he was probably worried about, could there be blood spatter or other hairs or anything else? I'm going to get this cleaned up methodically. But where I don't think it could be, I don't think he gave a crap.
We've seen, you know, the stained bedding and bagged hairs documented. When they went into this this scene, how are they deciding what could be potential evidence versus just everyday contamination?
Well, I tell you what, when you work a case like this, Tony, and you go in, you are taking everything. You're erring on that side of complete caution. In other words, you don't want to miss anything. So anything you see that even might be blood or bodily fluid or a pet hair that could be relevant, you are taking that all. And, you know, we've seen crime scenes where they haven't done that, and that's never good.
The Elantra, we know, was photographed, and it had some white powdery residue on it from processing. We also heard from investigators that the car was basically disassembled. And obviously, yes, they did some more disassembling when they went through to try and get anything out of it. What does that tell you about someone? And how often is it that a perpetrator is able to literally disassemble the car to such a level that they're not able to really get much of anything out of the vehicle, which, I mean, as far as we know, there really wasn't much found within the confines of that vehicle in terms of any sort of DNA or anything, really.
Well, there were so many of us, Tony, that said, mm-hmm. listen, and this was based on our experience, right? You can cover up a lot, but you can't cover up typically blood that would spatter down between that seat or on that gear shift or on those pedals if it was on your feet. You can't cover up everything. Well, you know what? Brian Koberger proved us all wrong, because he went to the nth degree to disassemble that car and make sure every crevice and cranny was thoroughly cleaned. And as far as that, you know, kind of that spray of where they process, I think, you know, I was trying to make the point, fingerprints, DNA, or was he really looking for were they also looking for bleach and cleaning mm-hmm. solvents? That's what really I believe they were looking for more than anything, is to show cleanup products being used as opposed to fingerprints or anything like that. I mean, I've dusted for fingerprints before. It typically isn't that hot mess you see there. Sure. I think it was for other things they were looking for.
And what do we know about that yet? Do we have any of that data in terms of what, you know, what they did find, what they didn't find in terms of cleaning supplies and such? Obviously, you know, I remember back when they emptied a lot of the stuff out of that apartment, and we were all looking at, like, they had trucks full of stuff they were taking out of there. If I remember, there was mattresses and things. But I mean, when they take all that out and they go and take a look at it, and obviously the trial never took place, do we know yet what was all found exactly after examination in the home of Koberger?
Well, it's interesting because all we know really is what Ann Taylor said in one of her motion responses or motions. That's what we know, her paperwork filed. And remember, this caused a huge, incensed sort of statement because basically the prosecution was saying, whoa, I thought everything was sealed. And we had a gag order, and you were finessing information really underneath that gag order by putting it in your motions and in your responses. And essentially in that, that's when she got to make this huge statement. Listen, there was no DNA found anywhere. I think what she wrote, I think it was DNA. I don't think she went so far to say as bodily fluids. I recall DNA. And again, that was a big moment. But other than that, Tony, that's all we really know.
I mean, could there be more out there? Could there be more that we just don't know? I mean, there was speculation for a long time. You know, was there animal hair in his apartment from the dog at King Road? Was there anything else? Are there still more pieces to this puzzle that have not yet dropped out of the box yet?
Well, I think, Tony, we all anticipated that happening. And so far, it hasn't come up. Really, we still have the backbone of this case being the PCA. Mm-hmm. Adding to that a little bit, you know, the search of Amazon and him purchasing the case was truly spelled out in that PCA. And I think there's been very little to really bolster their case beyond that. But we haven't seen the lab results. We have not seen anything from the FBI yet. So there's so much we haven't seen.
I guess the question is why? And will we?
Well, Tony, I think it'll take a while. Remember, at least according to the court, meaning Judge Hippler, he said, listen, nothing is getting out into the public until I have a chance to review. Now, do I think that's Judge Hippler looking at all of these terabytes of information? No, I think he has a staff and other people helping. But the bottom line is that's what he said. He doesn't want a lot going out without their review. So that makes it difficult. We also know, you know, now that a lot won't possibly come out because the families are upset. They don't want these crime scene pictures and more pictures, anything bloody, anything of their kids coming out, which I can hardly blame them. I've said, even if I see them, I'm not putting them up. Yeah. That's at least the dignity that I think they deserve and they've asked for.
And that's a big thing because we keep seeing stuff like that popping out. I have not witnessed anything bloody. I don't know if it's out there. I don't really want to see it. I hope that we don't really see any of that coming out. And obviously we do have a lot of pushback from the families, and understandably so. I don't quite see the purpose other than just transparency with the public. And then here's our information, but there's obviously, I don't know that gruesome crime scene photos have any place in the public sphere. I guess if you really wanted them, you could, I don't know if for investigative purposes, find some way, but I don't really see what the purpose is of those getting out into the public anyhow.
Well, I think, Tony, the backlash on the other side is from media has to do with all the other crime scene photos we've seen. We've seen Benet, you know, guillotined up. We've seen, or not guillotined, sorry, garroted up. Yeah. We've seen crime scene photos from the Menendez. All the famous cases and cases that aren't famous, we get to see crime scene photos. Madeline Soto, I mean, let me tell you, some of those things I can't unsee, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Really to do with his bizarre looking anatomy that was not normal. But I digress. My point is, and the point they're trying to make is, look, why are we covering all of this up or not allowing it to be out when it's out in all these other cases? And my point back to the people is, listen, you don't have families screaming about this, going to the level of hiring attorneys to file motions. This is very important to them. Mm-hmm. So let's honor that.
All right. So let's zoom out and be honest about what those images actually buy us. They don't hand over a smoking gun. They do something a little subtler. They show discipline. where he's expected to have scrutiny and sloppiness where he didn't. Meticulous bathroom and bed areas versus a pantry war zone. A car processed to the nth degree because he probably anticipated that's where a story could hide. If you're trying to read the offender's mind, that split screen is the tell. It says, I'm not tidy by nature. I'm tidy when I have to be. That's a posture, not a personality. And it lines up with what we know about offenders who plan the optics of their lives as much as the logistics. We also hit the ethics wall, and it's worth staying there for a second. Transparency is not a moral free-for-all. You can inform the public without turning grief into content. Families drawing lines around what is and isn't acceptable are not trying to rewrite history. They're trying to live with it. Most of us don't need to see blood to understand horror. And frankly, the banality of these apartment shots, the grocery debris, the blanks on the walls, the sterile emptiness, that's disturbing in its own way. It tells you a person can be sitting in a life that looks like nothing and still be capable of everything. When the volume of material is this big, it's easy to start treating every scuff, smudge, and cupboard as a breadcrumb. That's how you wind up making meaning out of noise. What matters is pattern and priority. The clean zones, the likely path of post-offense movement, the tools and cleaners that might have been used, the vehicle treated almost like a crime scene in its own right. Those pieces hold up over time. They teach and they warn. Here's where I land. This release should narrow our focus, not widen our speculation. It reminds us that performers can look organized when it's performative, and be a mess when they think they're off stage. It also reminds us that evidence tells us two stories, the one in the lab and the one in our head. We only get to publish one of those responsibly. We're going to leave this part here and pivot because there's another thread that needs stitching. The photos show the interior, the late released antidotes show the mask, those small unsettling micro interactions, that sketch of who he was in public spaces, the billing blow up at a hotel desk that we're going to talk about, the charm switch up, the hallway chatter about knives and sheaths, moments that don't prove cases but do reveal patterns. We're going to be diving into that next. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss that conversation. Wherever you're listening to us or watching us, be sure to hit that subscribe button. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi as we'll dive into the micro encounters of Brian Koberger next. You know, hitting on people, talking about knife sheaths. Yeah, before a murder. That's coming up. Stick around. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.